Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is Frank Gorin, a name you may recognize if you're a news junkie, and I certainly am. Frank has just released a really interesting memoir, Looking for Dad. Frank, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you, Simon, for inviting me, and it's good to be with you.
Looking for Dad was not exactly what I expected. I was thinking it was going to be, Frank Gorin, Emmy-winning, producer, newsman. It's not at all about that. It's actually a deeply personal exploration of your religious beliefs. I sat and thought long and hard about this book. I read it, and normally, the moment I close a book, I open up my word processor and I start writing the review. I couldn't do it this time. I just had to think about this book and what prompted you to write it. My personal view is that the catalyst might just have been the very unfortunate death of your son Buff in a boating accident. Am I way off base?
Well, not exactly. No, this book had been hiding inside me for a long, long time, and because I spent 35 years in the journalism business, broadcast journalism, and it didn't seem to me that it was time yet to begin to reveal anything, the material that's in Looking for Dad, some of which is kind of crazy and funny now and then, but it didn't go along with my self-image or public image at the time that I was working in the news business. So I knew it would have to wait until I got out of all that and retired. I'm not actually retired now. I'm semi-retired and still keep busy. But the answer to your question, the death of my son was not the original catalyst for wanting to write the book. I'd started many years or decades before. But it helped give it a kind of depth that I myself could appreciate. I began to see the story more clearly after his death.
Yeah, and the reason I asked the question is that it's something like 7/8 of the way through the book. Suddenly you reflect on your son's death, and to me that, the light bulb went on. Ah, spotted it. But yeah, it was a trigger.
Well, it was. Well, you know, this brings up something that I don't think I've told anyone before, but during his funeral, as I was sitting in the church pew, it occurred to me for the first time that I was kind of sandwiched between two deaths. My father died when I was two, and that's the Looking for Dad aspect of the story. But then my son, I was named after my father, Frank Gorin, and my son also, Frank Gorin. And I was the one Frank Gorin who still existed, although the first and the last were gone now, both taken by death. So I was kind of boxed in by death. And I realized that really was the story, and one of these days I would have to sit down and look at it that way. I did wait for a long time in terms of the book itself, because my son's death doesn't come out until quite late in the book.
Indeed. I found Looking for Dad a deeply, deeply philosophical work. And the more I think about it, the more convinced I become that in your youth, it was not so much a case of you being religious, but more enamored with the concept of religion.
Yes, I think so, yes. And perhaps many people are, if not most, when we first come in contact with religion, we become enamored, and enamored is a word that comes from love, amor. And so we're touched by a kind of love that we don't experience normally. It's something different, something deep inside that we don't quite understand, and that it's usually expressed in very symbolic and metaphorical ways in churches. So yes, I think I was touched. I was enamored by religion.
I think that aspect actually comes through in one of your attempts to become a monk. Now, I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of people listening to this that are going to be going, Frank Gorin, monk? He's the news guy. He's not a monk guy. But well, I suspect that the senior monk that interviewed you saw right through the facade. In fact, in the book, you kind of left with your tail between your legs.
I certainly did, but I'm not sure that he was right on the mark either. That was a very tragic thing, that, or at least actually it was very silly in a way. But I wanted to be a monk, and I took I hitchhiked across the country and went to the one monastery I wanted to be in, Gethsemane in Kentucky. This was where Thomas Merton, who was a writer that I loved very much, and whose autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, really set me in motion for the whole monk business. But so I encountered, as you say, a senior monk down there who was in charge of pre-interviewing people who came to announce that they were going to become monks too. And this fellow happened to have been a psychiatrist before he got in the cloister. And he did see through me. I don't know how accurately he saw, but yes, he did. I left the monastery with my tail between my legs. And that was really, I think, in a way, the beginning of the end of that phase of my life where I went off seeking sainthood and monkhood, hitchhiking, sleeping in pastures and ditches, and never having any money. And so the romance of that came to an end after that incident at Gethsemane. You're right, I think he saw into me.
Was this the occasion where you also had a bicycle, but the tire had blown up, or...?
No, that came before. That was in another monastery, actually a hermitage, that was founded by the Camaldolese order. That is one that had just a few hermitages in the whole world, and none in America until this time in the 1950s. And they founded one on the Big Sur coastline of California in some really spectacular country, on top of a mountain overlooking the sea. Well, that was just fine. And I thought, well, that has to be my future. So I quit the job I had at that time. I was a disc jockey, and pedaled down from where I was living in Salinas, California, all the way to Big Sur, and went up there, and that didn't work out either. without telling the whole story, which also I think is pretty comical and kind of tragic at the same time. That didn't work. I won't tell the story. I'll leave any potential reader to find out.
It is a very interesting. Comical, humorous, yeah, but there's also a lot of soul-searching going on in that period of your life.
Yes, there is. Well, the soul-searching really began while I was a very small child. I don't remember not soul-searching in a way. I missed my father. I never knew him, never remember anything about him, because he died, as they say, when I was two. Some people can remember back that far. I never was able to. But I was named after him. I was Frank Gorin. And yet no one in my family and extended family, grandparents, etc., wanted to talk about him. You couldn't bring up the subject. It was the book was closed on him. And, you know, kids can be very perceptive, more so than I think grown-ups realize. A child, after the age of around 4, 5, 6, can be pretty perceptive and can pick up things. So that I certainly picked up, that my father was not the subject of discussion. And
right.
I didn't know what kind of message that gave me, but I knew that somehow I had to find out. And that's what looking for Dad is about, in a way, although it's not so much about him in the end as about looking for a father principle in myself.
You flirted with various religions, including the teachings of the Far East. Have you finally found your home?
Well, I got interested in Buddhism, specifically Zen, at first Zen, back in the mid-1980s when I was living, working in New York, and happened to, completely by accident, if there are such things, pass a Zendo, that's a Zen meditation center, in Manhattan, on the east side. I was walking to a subway stop, and I passed this building that said New York Zen Studies Society, and that was the beginning. I came back and was taught how to sit in sitting meditation, which is called Zazen, and then started doing studies into Buddhist principles and how to sit and meditate and what it's all about. And that has stayed with me, and it's still a part of me, very strongly a part of me. Do I consider myself a Buddhist? I don't know what any ism is, Catholicism or Buddhism. The ISM part of it is not really important, so as important to me as the practice and the theory of it. So, yes, I feel that part of me is Buddhist in outlook and, as you say, a philosophy, if you can consider Buddhism a philosophy. But also, I'm a Catholic, a practicing Catholic, and I don't feel those things are, putting those two things are a problem for me. They might be for other people, or they might be a problem for other people that I think so, but it's not for me.
I found your early life to be just a little bit of a dichotomy. On the one side, we have the occasionally very pious young Frank Gorin, and on the other hand, we have a rather freewheeling character, you know, the beer-drinking, girl-chasing Frank Gorin. How did you reconcile the two sides of your life?
Well, that beer-drinking and girl-chasing, it was fundamentally me. And I guess there's still a bit of that in me, though it's I'm a 73-year-old man, and I don't indulge in any of that anymore. Still, it's part of my character. And I think I was drawn to religion in the first place because it seemed a kind of romance. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of, but in this case, the object was God, whatever that was. And I loved the symbolism and the metaphorical nature of especially Catholicism, which seemed to me to have more it was more attractive to me than the Protestant variety that I was actually raised with.
Yeah, in fact, on that subject, is it the pomp and circumstance that attracted you to Catholicism?
I think that was a part of it, the liturgy, the liturgical aspect. That the very first Mass I ever attended, that I described in the book, where I had actually was taking religious lessons from a Lutheran minister, and I had talked a friend into coming with me to a Lutheran church. He had been raised in a Catholic family, but that family hadn't had anything to do with religion for a long, long, long time. But anyway, my friend said, yes, okay, he would go. But it turned out that we were too late to get in. It was too late on that Sunday morning. So he said, why don't you come to my church instead? And though I didn't want to, and I was very anxious about going, stepping inside of a Catholic church, I went.
Yeah, actually, that's a very, very humorous part of the book.
Well, I went in, and I was, by the time it was over and we stepped out, I was totally swept away. The first thing I had to do was, he told me before we even got there, was to cross myself. And I thought, well, this would be a very dangerous thing to do because I'm not sure I want to do that. And he taught me how to do it. And then he said, when we get there, you're going to have to cross yourself by putting your hand in a font of water and crossing yourself with this holy water. And so this was even more scary. And but he taught me on the way down to this church how to do those things. And we went in, and I did it, and we walked into this church. It was really quite beautiful, and it was jam-packed with people. I think it was an 11 o'clock Mass, a high Mass. And I found it wonderful. It was just, what did I find? I think I found that there was another way of talking about religion and experiencing religion other than just words, which is what I had found on the Protestant side, words and singing a song now and then, and reading scripture. This was different. It had beginning with water as something holy, as you walk in the door, and then the incense and the burning candles and the Latin language. This was a long time ago, before Second Vatican Council. And
right.
So all of that was very mysterious to me, and I was drawn to it very, very strongly.
Your parents, as I recall, did not quite agree. Oh, sorry, your father was obviously dead, but your family did not exactly embrace your move to Catholicism, as I recall.
Oh, no, not at all. Because my sister, 2 years older, had actually had she had gone down to that Catholic church too, and she'd come back talking about becoming a Catholic, and that was, as I describe in the book, she may as well have come back to say that she was going to pack up and head to Haiti and study the local folk religion, you know. So this was a tremendous controversy that started at home, and my mother and my sister had huge arguments, and my sister cried, and finally she had to give in and promise she would never go down to that church ever again. And here it was, probably 2 or 3 months later, here was I was come back talking about saying the same thing, but my mother gave in because she knew there was no way she could stop me. And so I took off on my own at that point. I was, I think, 14 or 15 years old.
I find that interesting. I was brought up Protestant Church of England. I'm not a practicing person. But I think that if people find comfort, find succor in, you know, whatever religion they wish to delve into, more power to them. And I have two grown children. I have an 18-year-old stepson. And, you know, if he came to me and said, hey, I'm going to become whatever, I'd just go, okay, that's fine. You know?
That sounds to me like you, and for what little I do know about you and talking to you, it sounds like the open-minded person that I'm sure you are. And maybe it's because you didn't have such a strong connection to religion in the first place that you hadn't invested so much in it, and it didn't. You didn't come from the same mental place as my mother did when she was talking to my sister.
Right. Actually, what I think I'm trying to say is, if this is, you know, what gives you comfort, then go for it.
Yes, comfort is one part of it. But you know, the religion, if it's all comfort, you've got to ask yourself if you're doing the right thing, because there's much more to it, and I think the deeper part of it is in coming to realize or trying to realize that a religion represents a way to come to the deepest part of yourself, to find out who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
What's your deepest identity and being? And this you don't get anyplace else that I know of. You don't get it in not even in-depth psychology or philosophy.
Right. It's very much a looking inward.
Yes, it is. It's a looking inward and also practicing it in an outward way, the morality and the love that one learns in religion, practicing in an outward way in compassion and patience, understanding. But I think, I don't know of any other place where you can find all of those things except in religion, and I think the higher religions, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam is a very deep and beautiful religion, outside of the crazies who are working with it and using it as an excuse for something that's not very religious at all. And the Christians have been good at that too in the past with crusades and inquisitions and so on and so forth.
Oh, I'm yeah. We could talk for days on that subject. You know, even the title of your book elicited questions in my mind. Looking for Dad. In fact, you even start the book with a section about your father, Frank Gorin Sr. The title of the book, though, is a little bit of a misnomer. It's a play on words.
Go ahead.
It is not Frank Sr. that you're seeking. It's yourself.
Yes, yes, it is. It's just a kind of analogy, looking for Dad. But originally, actually, I was going to call it Looking for Merton, as Thomas Merton, because he was the fellow that the monk and writer Thomas Merton, who I went searching for down in Kentucky when I got kicked out of that monastery. So I thought, well, Looking for Merton, someone suggested that, another writer and editor. So he said, why don't you just call it Looking for Merton? And so I toyed with that for a long time, and then I finally thought to myself, well, Merton, too, is only just stands for something else. And I thought, well, why not just Dad? But it's true, as I said before, that I wasn't really looking for Frank Gorin Sr. The more I learned about him, the less mysterious he became.
In fact, in your explorations writing this book, did you find Frank Sr. in the metaphorical sense?
No, I don't think so. No, he will always be a mystery to me, and but not the one that puts me in thrall anymore. I found out after growing up myself and having children, and that he was a human being like the rest of us, and he did some pretty he did some things that weren't right. And I think that the relationship with my mother turned out to be not that they had their own problems, and he's just one of us. He's just one of us.
I think, I look at my family, and my father has passed away, and I have very fond memories of him. But I also remember some not so good things, and I think that's true in any family.
Yes, I think so, that when tragedy happens to us, or when great and wonderful things happen, we think that we're completely singled out and blessed and set aside. But I think the older that we get and the more we find out about human beings and human nature, we find out that it's all pretty ordinary in a way, and it's unlovable, and life is amazing, and it's a great trip.
Is Looking for Dad your first book?
First and probably last, because it took me 50 years to write
Are you just getting warmed up?
it. Yeah, I'm getting warmed up. I think I'll be way past 100 when the next one comes out. No, I'm not sure that I'll ever write another book, although I'm already thinking about one and coming up with some ideas for it. The book is based on diaries and journals that I kept for decades. I think I always wanted to be a writer, and was just amazed with books when I was just a toddler. I'd like to. My mother told me that I would carry books around and take them to bed with me up in my cradle, practically, and because I like to sleep with books. So I guess that was meant to be. It just took me an awful long time to make one myself.
I talk to an enormous number of authors, and you're in fact the only the second one that I have ever spoken to that has said, "Oh no, this is it. One book, I'm done." The other gentleman was just as adamant. And guess what? I got an email the other day. I'm working on my second book. Should be coming out
I'm working on mine somewhere in my mind, but I just don't have a title for it, or I couldn't describe it. But maybe it'll dawn on me before it's over. I went took a trip to Europe last year, and actually this year, earlier this year, and went back to France, which I love. I love to go there and wander around. And I'm thinking that maybe something about being in France and would ignite another book. And but it hasn't done that so far.
I'm not much of a gambling man, but I have a dollar in my pocket that says we're going to be seeing another book by Frank Gorin.
All right. Well, I'll tell you, I'll bet you that right now in front of everybody, and hope that I have to pay you off someday.
What sort of reader feedback are you getting about the book?
I really don't know yet, because it's so soon. This is just happening all at once in the past couple of months. I can count it in days, really. And the press release went out on it, first one, and I think that's where you found out about it, through a press release, was it? Or,
Yes, indeed it was. Yep.
and so the only feedback I've gotten so far is comes as a result of that, when we've got quite a few requests for review copies of the book to send out. Lots and lots of of these review copies for people to write about in a newspaper or a column or a or online or whatever, a magazine. And that I'm hoping to. I really would like to read those reviews and see what really what people don't like about it more than what they like about it.
Oh, I. If you come across any bad reviews, you send them to me, and I'll take those people out back and beat them senseless.
All right, that would discourage future critics, I'm sure.
I talk to many authors, and basically writing the book's the easy part. Getting people to buy it's the real trick. What are you doing from a marketing standpoint? Are you doing book signings, things like that?
Not yet. I expect that will happen pretty soon, as soon as the circulation begins. But I suppose that will be part of it. In the meantime, I'm just working on the getting the word out, trying to get some reviews. The book is you can find it at Amazon, just as you would any book, just going and writing Looking for Dad. I think there are some other titles, actually, Looking for Dad, that have to do with something very different, you know, house cleaning or God knows what. But mine happens to be the first one, and I'm thankful for that. The first one in the list of that. So people can find it at Amazon. And after that, already working on bookstores, et cetera, et cetera.
The internet is a powerful tool. You mentioned Amazon. Do you also have a website that people can visit?
Yes, I do, and that's also a way to get the book. It's www.openpathbooks.com, P-A-T-H, Open Path Books. And that goes directly to the site where the book is. And there's some, the reader can read some excerpts from the book. I think there's even a picture of me in there. And then you click if you want to buy it, and that takes you straight to Amazon.
This is way outside the realm of the book, but I'm just one of those naturally curious people. You got into radio on the ground floor. You were spinning discs and I believe doing some advert work, you know, on air. How did you move into the news industry?
Well, I think the whole broadcasting magic for me was when I was a very small kid, and this was during World War II, and probably even before, because we didn't get into the war until 1941. I was born in 36. But when I was in my earliest memories, I'm in a room, and there's a great big radio, and on the radio, everything is coming. The world is coming out of that speaker, but among the things are newscasts and the voice of Franklin Roosevelt. And then when the news wasn't on, there were dramas and comedies and things. And I thought this was probably the most astonishing thing there was so far about the world that I knew as growing up. And I thought, wouldn't it be something someday if I could get involved in that? And it wasn't until after I got out of the Army, I was 21, and then I simply walked into a little 250-watt radio station in my hometown, Alton, Illinois, and asked for a job. Well, I had no experience. I told them I had no experience, but I was ready to learn. And they actually hired me to work on weekends as a disc jockey, reading commercials and newscasts and playing records. That was the beginning for me, and the rest... It took many years spinning records, but then I wanted to get out of that someday and get into journalism, and I had a chance in Las Vegas, Nevada, many years later, and from then on, it really worked for me.
I believe you have an Emmy under your belt.
That was for a documentary that I did in San Francisco for KPIX TV. I did several documentaries for them, And that one, San Francisco, you know, is known as a homosexual or gay homeland in a way. And many gays are attracted there, of course. And but this was, let me see, the year of the Emmy was, 73, I think, 1973. And but it still wasn't very common to see interviews or television interviews about the subject. It was still a bit no-no. And so mine was the first documentary. And what triggered it was there was a fellow named Harvey Milk. That's a name that may ring a bell.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Harvey Milk was then running for the Board of Supervisors. And so there was what you call it. In the news business, you need what's called a hook to hang a story on. So that was the hook. Here's a homosexual running for the Board of Supervisors. And that was the opening, really, so that we could get into a lot of other things about the gay life in San Francisco and to fill out the rest of the whole documentary. And then, actually, there were elements of that documentary that was aired later when Harvey Milk was shot to death. And mm-hmm. then, again, CBS News used some of it. And then again, when the movie Harvey Milk came out recently, parts of it were used again in connection with that. So yes, that was a good one. That turned out well for me.
Frank, our time is just about up. I'm being whined at by my producer. You know, stop this. We've got to get off air.
I know what that's like.
Right. Do you have... I'm sure that there is one question I haven't asked. What is that question, and what's your answer?
What question? You're going to have to help me with that one.
Well, okay. Right. Why haven't you... written a book about your days as a journalist?
Well, I think there's too many people have already done that. I'm not going to write a book on journalism when everybody else, people who are household names, have done the same thing. I'd rather just stick to this all-consuming love of mine of finding out, of looking for Dad, in a way. I'll just go on looking, and in the process, if there's another book in me, that'll be fine. Dad is just another name for God, I suppose, and God is a name for something very mysterious that's in everybody and in everything. And looking for that fundamental thing is what looking for Dad is about. So I'll just go on searching.
My guest today has been Frank Gorin. Frank, this has been a wonderful half an hour. I do hope that we can talk again. I think your book, Looking for Dad, is an absolute must read. It is by no means a book that is aimed at religion. However, religion is very much a major part of it. You have revealed a part of your soul that few people would have the guts and determination to do that. You've opened up some part of yourself that I can't think of another writer that has done that.
I hope so, Simon. I really do. That's and what you're saying now, your words are very comforting to me and inspiring. I feel like getting on that bicycle again and going down the road.
Make sure that you have a spare inner tube this time.
Right. And some good excuses of why I'm doing it.
Right. Frank, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I'm sure we will talk again. This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network. That's www.bloggernews.net. Wishing everyone a wonderful day, and I'm sure we will be talking again soon. Goodbye.